Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Well, I think it's been a pretty amazing week, hasn't it? We've done our two royals last week, and I think the figures are looking pretty good.
Yeah, we must do this again, you know, two episodes in a week. People seem to lap it up.
Yes. Well, actually, it'd be interesting to hear what people say. You know, I quite like the idea of having two counterbalancing speakers on an issue quite close together, because I think we got quite a lot of debate going, didn't we?
Yes, we did. We did. And I think the fact that we'd done one programme made more people come back for the second. Yeah. You know, we got 20,000 views on YouTube pretty much in about 4 days, which for us is amazing. Yeah. I don't know yet about Apple, but I'm sure that's been quite good. And loads of hundreds of comments, people arguing with us, arguing with each other, but really engaged in what both Colin Campbell and Clive Irving said.
Gosh. And was there any particular, sympathy one way or the other, or was it pretty balanced?
Well, I think maybe each speaker attracts a slightly different audience. I think a lot of people listening to Clive were inclined to be kind and maybe understanding towards Meghan and Harry and think that there is something in this racism allegation. You know, and listen to what he said about the history of the royal family and Britain's history with empire and how that somehow connects to this. And maybe it's a sort of no smoke without fire argument, but people do buy it. Whereas with Lady Colin Campbell, you know, the people that she brings in, and she brings in a lot, are inclined, I think, to take her views, which is that, you know, Meghan essentially is winding Harry up and trying to kind of use racism, really, to settle scores, advance her own career, whatever, I don't know.
Gosh, and what's your take on the royal family's response? I mean, it's been quite sort of measured, but they say they're going to look at all options, aren't they?
Well, I was going to ask you that, Andrew. You're our expert. They've been so quiet. That's the thing that surprised me.
Well, I mean, that's always the policy, that the problem will go away, don't fan the flames of publicity, sit it out, and it'll be fine. And I think public support, certainly in this country, is for the royal family. They've been given, feel that these are very unfair accusations, was my reading of the press. And I think what will be interesting to see is with the leak in Holland, whether that was deliberate and they basically sacrificed the Dutch print run, which is very small, or whether it was an accident. So if the agent, for example, is sued for making that mistake, blaming the Dutch publisher, but it looks possible that the script was sent before it was legal, which I find very surprising.
Yeah, I mean, if you remember when Oprah happened and this allegation was first aired about the baby, they did release the famous statement. The Queen herself released a statement. It was seen as so serious.
Yeah.
You know, recollections may vary, she said.
And William saying, we're not a racist family.
And William saying, we're not a racist family. I mean, now we know that Kate's in the frame for this. That perhaps explains the kind of vehemence and strength of feeling that we saw in William that week, don't you think?
Yeah. Yes, possibly. I mean, what surprised me, too, is that more figures haven't come forward to talk about the work of the royal family to combat racism. I mean, if you think of the King's Prince's Trust, I think now called the King's Trust, you know, he's done an amazing job to help young Black, particularly young Black people. So it's strange. They're having to fight this battle on their own, and you would have thought there would have been more people coming forward, at least speaking on their behalf, which isn't the case.
Well, yes, they've been very quiet, and so too has Harry and Meghan. They've said nothing, because this is the most extreme version of the allegation we've heard, that they're naming Charles and they're naming Kate. Somebody has named them, apparently in a letter which somehow got to this writer. They're obviously just, I don't know if they're enjoying the spectacle. I mean, Harry's been in court, I think, on two different cases, or his lawyers have.
Yeah, still fighting the protection thing. I mean, I find that slightly ironic, because he's the one who actually blew the floor plan of Buckingham Palace and Spare, which actually may have put the royal family security at risk. And I'm still waiting for a decision from my November 2022 tribunal on the 1932 file that was supposed to jeopardize the security of the royal family today. So, I mean, there's not a consistent approach to all this. You know, the royal family seem to be able to leak their own secrets, but we're not allowed to look at the documents which are now in the archives.
Well, you obviously need to hire Harry's lawyers, Andrew. It's easy.
Yes, indeed, yeah. But yes, no, it's the story's running. I think that their silence speaks volumes. I mean, this would be an opportunity for that rapprochement they're so keen on. And as you say, I mean, it's extraordinary. They haven't said anything. They're just letting the story run and take it.
Maybe there's more. I mean, some people have speculated, maybe there's more. Maybe there were more explicit conversations around race. Perhaps he confronted them at some point. Maybe Meghan said something. I don't know. It is weird to me that they're so quiet, because as we discussed with Clive, it's extremely damaging, especially outside Britain, to have this hanging over them, I think.
Yes, well, it'd be interesting. We have had some comments from you know, around the world, from Australia and the Caribbean. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how people view the situation there, because that's where it's going to be played out, not so much here in the States, as Clive said.
Everybody who's found the show, and if you're still with us today, if you're enjoying what we're doing, if you're part of the 20,000 that tuned in last week, you know, it's very easy to click the little subscribe button. We're still keen to get more and more of those. It really helps us get prominence on YouTube. The more clicks we get and the more comments apparently we get, the higher we get up the kind of mysterious algorithm. So it'll pop up in more people's feeds.
Yes, that would be great, because, I mean, people seem to enjoy the range, and it's a very eclectic range, and they seem to feel that we are fair in our comments or our interviews with people. We let them speak. And a lot of podcasts are not like that. I think listening to other podcasts, there's a nice balance that we have.
Well, we certainly try. Well, talking of balance and variety, should we move on to Jimmy Savile?
Yes, and more scandal.
Yeah.
This could be very interesting. So it's something people keep asking about, and it's actually not a subject I know much about, though he was friends with two of the people I've written about, Lord Mountbatten and Andrew.
Well, I think we should give a very quick pen portrait of this man to anybody outside Britain who's never heard of him, because he was an extraordinarily odd and very British character. Incredibly famous and popular here. One of the country's first disc jockeys, a radio personality, TV personality in children's television, friend of royalty, a friend of politicians, one of the country's most successful charity organisers, and just a really big figure in national life in the 70s and the 80s.
Big to fail, I suspect.
Yes, yes. Well, the man we're going to speak to, his book, what's it called, Andrew? Is it In Plain Sight?
Yes.
Yep. Yes. So what happened was, you know, almost in plain sight, throughout his career at the very top of kind of show business in Britain, he was repeatedly targeting young girls, illegally young girls and teenage girls who were of age, predatory groping, grabbing, and more serious sexual offences were then later came out when he died, rape and all manner of abuse. And it turned out he'd been given access to institutions that he should never have been anywhere near. And it also turned out that lots of people had complained, but those complaints had gone nowhere. And I thought, just to give a flavour, I found this amazing quote from Savile's own book. He wrote his own autobiography in the 70s, where he openly talks about his life as a disc jockey in the clubs in Yorkshire, where he made his name, and how teenage runaways would fall into his grasp, and he would take them home, and he would have sex with them. And he uses phrases like, once we'd had our fun with them, we gave them back to the police. And one day, a police officer, a female police officer, wanted to take him to, wanted to pursue this and wanted to bring charges. And this is the quote that Savile, who's made it his business to get to know the coppers, by the way, he's already friends with the police and he's doing charity gigs and he's always there with the chief constable on the telly. And he says this, "This woman officer was dissuaded from bringing charges against me by her colleagues, for it was well known that if I were to go down, I'd probably take half the station with me."
Gosh.
It's such a horrible insight into
the
politics of Britain in those days.
Yes. Well, it shows how attitudes have changed. I mean, you know, it's extraordinary what people were able to get away with. And there was much more, I suppose, deference to people like that. And I mean, we're still seeing a lot of cover-ups. I think one of our themes in some of the next few episodes is scandals with cover-ups.
Indeed, indeed. And a lot of victims of Savile, which actually included his own niece, by the way, but they tended to be girls from poor backgrounds, and maybe they were in homes, and he found his way to get into those places and to meet those people, and they had low status. People did not listen to them, and many of them did complain. Many of them did. And the police actually investigated him, I'm sure that Dan, our interviewee, will explain, multiple times, and nothing was done.
Yeah. No, it is shocking, and one worries that these things still go on, and rich and powerful people are able to avoid any sort of scrutiny.
I think that's true. Do you know Dan, actually? I've never met him before.
No. I mean, you know, we often rely on our own contacts, but it's just because he is the expert on the subject that we approached him.
Yes, and there was a recent BBC drama, which was really very good, which I think, if it wasn't based on his book, it was largely influenced by it, I think.
Yes, no, I think it was based on his book.
It was. No,
I think it'll be a very interesting program, I'm sure.
All right, well, I forget, is it Madeleine McCann next week?
I'm not quite sure. I thought...
Or Jeremy Thorpe, I'm not sure either.
I'm not sure. Well, let's make it Madeleine McCann, how about that?
Well, a lot of people have asked us to do the Madeleine McCann show, so... Okay, fingers crossed, because we don't always control these things as well as we'd like. I think people change their plans and we have technical issues. But Madeleine McCann next week. Jimmy Savile now. What do you say?
Let's go for it.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Dan, welcome.
Thank you very much, Phil. Cheers.
And hopefully Andrew will be turning up in a moment.
Oh, well, we'll wait with bated breath.
Well, I'm really looking forward to speaking to you. It's been a tricky interview to arrange because you're such a busy man these days. And we were saying in our little introduction that you're actually in an actor playing you is in the recent Jimmy Savile drama. Did you help them write that as well?
I didn't help them write it. No, it was written by Neil Mackay. I didn't have anything to do with it other than a couple of meetings early on. Mark Stanley played me, which was quite a strange experience. They did play with a few aspects of my story. I mean, the overarching arc and trajectory of it was correct, but there were details that were massaged, shall we say, in the name of drama. It was a powerful piece of work, and it very much mirrored the structure of the book, which was... In plain sight, which was based on a series of very long form interviews I did with Savile over 7 years, 6 or 7 years. And then, the structure of that book cuts between those interviews and, a sort of fairly forensic recreation of his past, and then jumps forward to also jumps forward to the sort of the scandal that erupted after his death, and how that sort of sucked in many different people and many different organizations and institutions, from the BBC to the National Health Service to the royal family and beyond. Mm.
Oh, I see Andrew is joining us. Hello, Andrew.
I'm sorry, apologies. I was doing something else. Didn't realize the time.
No worries at all. We're just starting. I was actually just going to ask Dan. Most of our listeners and viewers are not British, in fact.
Yeah.
And I doubt if many of them will have seen the drama that we've just talked about. Could you give, for somebody who really knows very little about Savile, your sort of two-minute upsum of kind of who he was and why he was so important?
Yeah, well, Jimmy Savile was an extraordinary figure in the sort of history of post-war British popular culture. He made his name in the dance halls of the 1950s in Northern England. He pioneered playing records for young people to dance to in dance halls rather than live bands. He became a sort of star within the Mecca organization, which ran over 100 dance halls, which are, you know, the equivalent of modern day nightclubs or discos across the country. And from that, he got his break in radio. He first went on to Radio Luxembourg with a show called the Teen and 20 Disc Club. And from there, he moved on to BBC Radio 1, and from there broke into television. Actually, it was television first. He was the first presenter of an iconic pop music show in 1964 called Top of the Pops, you know, at a time when pop music was erupting as a sort of cultural force across the world. He was a guy who was right on the breaking wave of that. And he from there, he became what I describe almost as Britain's first celebrity, somebody who was famous for being famous. And within that, he became renowned as a charitable fundraiser. So he was a very odd-looking character. He had sort of peroxide, white, blonde, dyed sort of blonde hair cut into this sort of medieval-style bob. He wore tracksuits. He wore sort of outlandish clothes. He wore garish jewelry. He always had a huge cigar in his mouth. He was like a caricature, really. He's what I describe as a sort of heat-seeking missile for publicity. Mm. So he was a huge figure, not universally loved. Quite a lot of people were suspicious of him because, I mean, myself included. But he managed to inveigle himself into extraordinary areas of British society and walk the corridors of power, whether that be with government, royal family, etc. He was from, you know, a working class, very, very poor working class background. So he rose up through these sort of social echelons to become a very powerful figure within the BBC, a very powerful figure within society at large through his charitable endeavours. But there were always rumours about him, and always whispers about he was never married. He never, you know, had a relationship that anybody knew of. And there were always rumours about his predilection for young girls. You know, there were rumours about paedophilia that never went away. And after he died in 2011, a year later, those rumours erupted with an ITV documentary in October 2012. And from there, the facade that he'd built around himself crumbled, and many hundreds of people came forward with testimonies of how they'd been abused by Jimmy Savile over the course of his 85-year life, you know, and of that, you know, 50 years of that at least had been spent in the public eye.
It is such an incredible story. Your own book, which is, I think, the definitive book, it's called In Plain Sight. And my father, by the way, I was saying this earlier to Andrew in the introduction, my father knew Savile. My father was a sort of local Yorkshire comedian and comic writer, and then went on to be a BBC producer. And he knew him from the days when he was working the clubs, and he always knew him as a thug, as a man to be avoided, a man to be slightly feared. You know, he's physically intimidating as much as anything else. And my younger sister had an autograph book. Those were the days where people would come to meet celebrities. And he said, no, you're not going to meet Jimmy Savile. You can meet all the other people I know, but he's a wrong'un. That's the phrase he used. He's a wrong'un, not somebody you'd leave your teenage daughter alone with or even introduce her to. And this was, we're talking now the mid-1970s. And apparently his own autobiography, he writes, which was published years before his death, he wrote quite openly about what he would do to teenage girls in the nightclub, knowing they were underage and boasting about it. And all this happened and nobody seemed to sort of care.
It was extraordinary. I mean, as you say, the title of the book is In Plain Sight. And his modus operandi really was to put it all out there. You know, he had a newspaper column in the Sunday People. As I said, he was this heat-seeking missile for publicity. And he put it all out there. He put it all out there in his autobiography, which was published in 1974. The stories were legion of him sort of picking up teenage girls and making, desperate, or not desperate, but sort of laughing escapes from suspicious parents. He talked about it, he wrote about it. And I think it was for him, it was this high wire act that I believe he got a great thrill out of, sailing so close to the wind, getting so close to the flame, and even to the point where, there were so many cases that once he died, I interviewed him from 2004. He died in 2011, and these interviews were sort of 3-4 days at a time. I'd sometimes stay with him in his flats in Leeds and Scarborough. He had this sort of nomadic existence where he bounced around the country. And what I was able to do after his death and after the tidal wave of allegations sort of destroyed the mystique or the facade of Jimmy Savile, is I was able to actually triangulate much of what he'd written in public, either in newspaper articles or in books or in interviews, etc., where he'd alluded to these liaisons, as he called it. And it was always a bit of fun with Jimmy Savile. It was always, nobody got hurt, I never took advantage of anybody, and all this sort of stuff. And I was able to sort of triangulate that with real people who it actually happened to. And often the case would be that he would be writing about this the week after he committed the offence. I mean, that's how sort of sick it was. But that's how he liked to sail very close to the wind. And he correctly sort of calibrated that the power of celebrity and his influence and the nature of his connections, which went right the way up into the very top echelons of government, to Prince Charles, now King Charles, the Duke of Edinburgh, Louis Mountbatten, Lord Mountbatten, who was the sort of, as you both well know, the sort of eminence grise behind the crown. He correctly calibrated the combination of his celebrity, his charitable good works, and his influence stroke connections would be enough to protect him. And when things got really close, and when the newspapers were onto him, he would play the card of, do you want me to pull the funding for this hospital? Are you really going to take down the guy that rebuilt this hospital or raises all the money for this? And that's what he did. And tragically, he was able to go to his grave with his reputation intact.
I mean, did the victims come forward to the authorities and they just didn't take them seriously? I mean, there was also a case of the BBC programme Newsnight pulling an investigation. I mean, what's the background to that?
Yeah, the victims did come forward, I mean, throughout his life. Not in the numbers that came forward after the ITV documentary. I mean, Marion Jones, who was the investigative editor of Newsnight at the BBC, was looking into Savile for many, many years. And the reason for this is that Marion, as a teenager, had an aunt, his mother's sister, I believe, who was the headmistress or the governess at a sort of a posh borstal or remand school for troubled girls in Surrey called Duncroft. Marion and his parents went to visit his aunt and witnessed Jimmy Savile sort of driving onto these grounds, which, they were gated, they were secure, they were meant to keep girls in. And he witnessed Jimmy Savile driving these girls off the grounds. So he was very, very suspicious, as were his parents, who remonstrated with his auntie, who was the head of this institution. So Marion was always suspicious. When Savile died, he went to his editor at Newsnight and said, I want to put this investigation into place. And very quickly, that investigation gathered pace. Myron was aware of people who were chatting, who were ex-Duncroft girls, and talking about how they'd been abused by Savile online. This chatter was happening in addition to, you know, people who'd come forward in the past and just been thrown out by the police or just dismissed. So Marion and Liz McKean had this investigation. It was not run by the BBC. It was axed. And this the controversy over that following the ITV documentary in October the following year led to the resignation of the Director General of the BBC. It was a huge, huge controversy, one that the BBC hasn't recovered from, in my view, and hasn't actually sort of, I don't think, accepted its true culpability for.
And why was it pulled? I mean, who put the pressure on the programme?
Well, there was a whole sort of report, inquiry done on it. The official line from the BBC is that Savile had been investigated by the police, Surrey police, in the 1990s over allegations from ex-Duncroft girls that there had been he'd committed abuse there. The fact that he was investigated over 2 years, the police investigation was deeply flawed. It culminated in an interview under caution of Savile at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, where he'd rebuilt the spinal injuries unit. So, and he dictated the venue for that interview, the timing of that interview, and even got one of his police officer acolytes in West Yorkshire to act as a go-between him and Surrey police. The Crown Prosecution Service decided not to take it forward, and the BBC took that as the fact that it didn't, you know, it wasn't taken forward. The BBC decided, well, actually, there's nothing to report here. The other angle of this was that the BBC had planned a number of big tribute shows to Jimmy Savile to run a couple of months after his death, you know, in the run-up to Christmas. Those tribute shows were broadcast, despite the fact that their sort of key investigative strand in Newsnight and two of their leading investigative journalists had uncovered compelling information about Jimmy Savile's offending. That investigation was shelved. It led to both Liz McKean and Marion Jones leaving the BBC or being forced out. It led to George Entwistle losing his job as Director General. The findings of the work that Liz McKean and Marion had done on that investigation were taken on by Mark Williams Thomas and added to. Mark sort of developed the investigation further and went even wider with it. And when that was broadcast in October of the year following Savile's death, it was highly controversial, but it also saw the dam burst in terms of the number of people that came forward in terms of with accounts of how they'd been abused, sexually abused, everything ranging from rape to fondling to, you know, everything you can imagine, and from an age range of, you know, infants all the way through to older people.
There's one particular story that always struck with me and just showed the power he had over not only the authorities but his own family. I think his niece complained that he'd abused her. She went to her own mother, Jimmy's sister, I think, and said, "Uncle Jimmy hurt me," and told.
Well, I interviewed.
Sorry, you probably know more about this than I do.
I interviewed Savile's nephew. I mean, this I think is extraordinary. Savile's nephew, Guy Marsden, I think had a sort of quite a troubled youth, I think would be fair to say, in Leeds. He ran away as a teenager with a couple of friends, ended up at King's Cross or Euston Station, which in the 60s and 70s was sort of a very seedy part of town in London and a notorious sort of pick up spots for waifs and strays. And they were picked up by some strange guy and taken to a dingy flat somewhere and put up, you know, by this adult male. And after a few days, this is the era before mobile phones and before the internet and email and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, Guy Marsden's family didn't know where he was. He'd run away from home. And then out of nowhere, Jimmy Savile comes to this flat and doesn't even bat an eyelid to see his nephew there. and then takes them off to another flat in London, installs them into another flat in London, and according to Guy, then took them to parties, which were, you know, the only people at those parties were children and adult males. And the role of Guy Marsden and his friends apparently was to sort of keep these children calm at these parties. So, yeah, I mean, the story is sort of truly sickening. I mean,
I think the sister said, "I'll have a word with Uncle Jimmy. He can sometimes go too far," as if that was it. Not, "I'm going to go to the police because my own child has been horribly abused." But there seems to be, I'm very interested in this difference between, you know, there are a lot of leering, leching, grabby, gropey men in media at that time. I worked with a few of them. But there's obviously a bit of a gulf between that and the kind of outright predator and sex offender and rapist, which was Saville. But somehow the fact that a lot of bad behaviour was tolerated, maybe that meant that the really vicious predators kind of were not identified. It was a permissive age, and maybe it wasn't cool to kind of call people up on behavior.
Well, commercial considerations too. Here he was, presumably a great success for the BBC. The last thing they wanted to do was diss their cash cow.
There was a huge, that was a huge factor without a doubt, Andrew. I mean, he was a powerful figure who delivered huge rating success with programs like Jim Will Fix It, which, for the benefit of your overseas audience, you know, ran from the 1970s all the way through to the late 80s or early 90s, I think it was. And Jim Will Fix It was effectively a dream fulfillment show where people, and mainly children, wrote in to Jimmy Savile asking for their dreams to be granted. And that could be anything from, you know, I don't know, swimming with dolphins to driving a racing car to singing with a pop group or whatever. But he was this sort of Father Christmas-like character. And he was this, he'd been sort of created as the nation's, an uncle to the nation's children, if you like, even a slightly odd looking and sinister uncle as I found him.
We did all the ads for safety ads for clunk click every trip.
Yeah, I mean, he did that. He released a book called Stranger Danger about to Phil's point. Yeah. You know, I grew up in an era where, you know, it was all about, oh, you don't want to go in the woods because there's that there might be strange men in there. But paedophilia as a term wasn't used. It wasn't a term that was in popular, it wasn't in the popular discussion. It wasn't something that people really acknowledged or spoke about. It was more about sort of strange men that you might encounter in the woods or, you know, on a dark night and things like that. And you had to be wary of them. And Jimmy Savile even wrote a book called Stranger Danger that was, aimed at children to warn them about, you know, going off with adult strangers. I mean, again, that was just a classic technique of his to sort of get as close as almost, you know, he started everything almost from the point of guilt and then move backwards. That was his MO. And, you know, with publishing a book like that, it's almost like, you know, that was almost a sort of archetypal example of that. But you're right. You're right, though, Andrew. He was a huge ratings winner for the BBC. He was a huge cash cow, both for the newspapers he worked for, the broadcasters he worked for, but also the charities. And, you know, particularly in the 1980s, when Margaret Thatcher came to power on a raft of spending cuts, here was a guy who was going to galvanize national fundraising appeals, the likes of which probably hadn't been seen since the Second World War. And, you know, the most sort of high profile was the rebuilding of the spinal injuries unit, the National Spinal Injuries Unit at Stoke Mandeville, which Jimmy Savile spearheaded and became this sort of national icon about and secured his knighthood through. And, you know, Margaret Thatcher campaigned for virtually the whole of her premiership to get him a knighthood. Every single honours list, she campaigned vociferously to get.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Get him a knighthood. She finally succeeded with her outgoing honours list. And his response in a memorable interview with Lynn Barber, the great broadsheet interviewer, she had pressed him on all the rumors about the fact that he liked young girls. Why do these rumors persist about you, Jimmy, despite everything that you've done, despite your image as a sort of fundraiser extraordinaire? And then she asked him about the knighthood, and his response was, "I'm off the hook." And I think that says it all. He realized that those sorts of, that level of influence, that level of society he penetrated and the accolades, that being the knighthood from Margaret Thatcher and his relationship with the royals, the fact he was a de facto advisor to Prince Charles, it made him untouchable. And it proved to be correct, unfortunately.
I mean, it's a weird thing because he was advising Charles and Diana on their marriage problems, and yet he'd never really had a relationship in his own life. I mean, it seems extraordinary naivety on the part of the royals to bring him so close.
Yeah, I mean, he claims that relationship with the royals started with Mountbatten through his work with the Marines at Limpstone in the southwest of England. And then that quickly sort of moved through the Duke of Edinburgh. I mean, to the extent where he was using the Duke of Edinburgh's private press office during the Stoke Mandeville campaign to put pressure, on major sort of donors like Victor Matthews, who owned the Daily Express at the time and was a building magnate. In the famous Squidgygate tapes, Diana talks of Jimmy Savile being a kind of mentor to Prince Charles. And, after Savile died, in the period between his death and the ITV documentary that outed him for what he was, there was an auction of all his, many of his sort of worldly possessions and belongings. And these range from sort of garish tracksuits and stage costumes and jewelry and cigars. But in there was a vast trove of letters and messages from members of the royal family, specifically Prince Charles. And in one, Prince Charles wrote, the country will never truly know what you've done for it. I mean, this was a relationship that was close and that was real. And Savile was seen as somebody who could speak sense to the heir to the throne and speak to him in the language of the common man, if you like.
I mean, there's some suggestion that Mountbatten may have had paedophile tendencies. I mean, was there any connection between the two of them, or was it purely on the level of charity and other things?
Well, I mean, according to Savile, I mean, I could find nothing, nothing on record about it. But according to Savile, Mountbatten recognized something in Savile. He recognized something of himself. So it's interesting that you say that, because, there was also psychiatric nurses who worked at Broadmoor Hospital, which was, again, for the benefit of overseas listeners, the biggest and probably most notorious psychiatric hospital in Britain, which houses some of its most dangerous and notorious criminals. And Savile effectively ran that hospital from 1988. And he had an association with Broadmoor that dated back to the late 60s. But psychiatric nurses in that hospital reported that paedophiles gravitated towards Savile. So I don't know about Mountbatten, but I do know that Savile told me that Mountbatten recognized something of himself in Savile. I think he described it as a sort of can-do attitude, a sort of like get on with it, get it done. But who knows what the reality of that really was.
Well, maybe it's also the public face and the private vice. That was perhaps the comparison. Wasn't he also allowed keys to certain institutions? So he could access wards?
He had keys to Broadmoor. I mean, Broadmoor housed, Peter Sutcliffe, Ronnie Cray, some of the most notorious killers and criminals in Britain. And Savile had keys. He had his own office there. He was able to come and go as he wished.
To have a chat with Peter Sutcliffe or something.
Yeah, I mean, he said to me, I said, well, you know, he met Peter Sutcliffe the first time when Peter Sutcliffe, after he was caught and sentenced, he went to Parkhurst first on the Isle of Wight. And Savile went there and met Sutcliffe there first. And he said to me that Sutcliffe was, in his words, as good as gold. Peter was as good as gold. He also organized a photo opportunity with the very unfortunate Frank Bruno at a time when Frank Bruno was recovering from, you know, quite a serious mental episode. And I think sort of Savile had this ability to identify people when they're at their most vulnerable. And I think he did that with Bruno as well. And there is a sort of infamous picture of Frank Bruno being introduced completely unawares to Peter Sutcliffe, you know, the Yorkshire Ripper in Broadmoor, while Savile looks on.
Because he was sort of playing with you too. I mean, you talk about him hiding in plain sight and almost taunting you at times to push him. And I mean, that must have been very difficult for you because you must have had your own suspicions but presumably wanted to draw him out.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely playing with me. I think he was trying to groom me like he groomed many other people. I think he was trying to groom me to secure his epitaph in print because he surely knew that once he died, it was all going to come out. I mean, the epitaph he wanted on his gravestone, which was on his gravestone, was "It was good while it lasted," which I think, you know, you can read into. But certainly he was playing with me. He was leaving this breadcrumb trail of clues. He was sort of pulling me on, but also he had me off balance. I mean, at times, you know, it wasn't always confrontational. I think that the BBC dramatization sort of, you know, it tells the story, but it's not as nuanced as it was, obviously. You know, at times he could be charming and beguiling and mysterious and funny, you know, almost funny at times, you know, not in a sort of comedic sense, but just sort of. But then he could be dark and sinister and menacing as well. And he certainly, I was interviewing him at a time where his celebrity had very much faded. He was a relic. He wasn't getting a lot of publicity other than the big magazine features that I was writing, which exposed these sort of very odd elements of his life, you know, the power, the influence, you know, not the paedophilia, because that nobody was able to nail that while he was alive. But yes, it was there's not a day that goes past where I don't wonder why, of all the people to become sort of fixated with from a journalistic point of view, it had to be him.
I mean, you talk of actually being quite upset when he died. I think you had a birthday party organised and you found it very difficult to really engage with the party.
Yeah, I mean, I was upset because I'd spent so long and I was trying to write this book and I didn't feel like I got to the truth. You know, the title of the book was initially going to be Apocalypse Now Then, you know, I mean, you know, in the sense that I felt that I was going up the river, up this sort of dark river, and there was going to be this climactic confrontation at the end when I'd found everything out and I was going to present it to Savile. But he died before I was able to do that. He died before, you know, I'd stopped interviewing him for about a year and a half because he'd said a few things to me that had made me very uncomfortable. And I thought, actually, I'd heard these, he told the same stories over and over again. And you had to be very patient for him to sort of reveal a chink of light that would then illuminate something that lay within. And you'd have to listen to a lot of the same stories. So I'd made the decision that I was going to go and find people from his past that knew him or worked with him or encountered him or experienced him and work in big, wide concentric circles. And then move my way in. And when I came right to the center of that, that's when I would go, I would be, you know, I'd gone down the river and I would have been at that climactic encounter where I was going to put everything to him. I'd started putting stuff to him, but this is from his very early days, you know. So I was upset because I felt like I'd wasted 7 years of my life and I didn't feel like I got to the truth. And I felt like this project that I was getting closer to was in vain. And I also, I think, you know, I won't lie that, you know, I didn't know what he was then. I had my suspicions about him, but I didn't know for sure. And I was upset that I hadn't been aware that he was ill and that he died and I hadn't spoken to him in some months before. So, and it was, you know, it was the day before my birthday and it was 2 days before his birthday. And generally, I phone him up on his birthday because it came after my own. And that would be sort of when we'd have a chat and we'd arrange the next meeting. So there was a whole slew of emotions that I was feeling at that time. There was frustration. There was sort of a certain element of sadness, because at that point he hadn't been exposed for what he was. And let's not forget that he had, in effect, a three-day quasi-state funeral. I mean, the outpouring of affection for him when he died could not be in more contrast or starkly contrasted to what we now know about him. And that's the sort of journey that I went on. And that's the journey that everybody, in a sense, has been on with Jimmy Savile.
Did he have any friends? It sounds like he formed relationships with journalists, perhaps more than with other people.
The thing about Savile is he moved around a lot. He had this nomadic life. And I think that helped him to keep his offending concealed. He had flats in Scarborough. He had a place in the Highlands of Scotland. He had a place in Leeds. He had a flat in London. He had motorhomes. You know, that he was constantly on the move. He never stayed in, and he had flats at, you know, at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, at Broadmoor. So you never quite knew where he was. He was always moving around. And in each of those locations, he had what he called a team, which would be sort of acolytes and enablers and sort of, you know, people that would come and indulge him when he probably wanted a bit of company, because he was a solitary figure. And like, you know, I think like a lot of predatory paedophiles, you know, he was a solitary figure. But at times he needed company, and he had these people that he could call on. Whether you would call them friends in the sense that the three of us would probably regard those closest to us as friends, I couldn't tell you. But, you know, amongst those groups, you know, the first time I interviewed him in Leeds, at his flat in Leeds, he was having one of his, what they were called, Friday morning clubs, which were, he'd have people over for a sort of coffee or a whiskey or on a Friday morning. And there were lots of West Yorkshire police officers or ex-police officers there, because, you know, as part of these sort of circles of security he built around himself, he cultivated relationships with the police from his very early days. And I arrived and I rang the doorbell and I was let into a little sort of vestibule area at the front. And he came down from his penthouse flat with two big guys at the front of this small lift. And they came out in front of him, and this big plume of cigar smoke sort of, you know, emerged from this small little lift. And he said, "Frisk him." And I was pushed up against the wall by these guys, one of whom was a former police officer. And I was frisked. And it was sort of like from the very first moment he was setting the rules of engagement.
Yeah. Wow, that's sinister.
And I mean, are there not stories of the Crown Prosecution Service, you know, beginning to create a file on him, and then files were disappearing and, you know, there were delays? It sounds like there was pressure being put on the prosecutors from some source.
Well, there were, you know, the Crown Prosecution Service did have, you know, were presented files from that 2-year investigation. I mean, the problem was that it was just sort of police ineptitude or corruption. You know, there is a requirement of police forces to share intelligence with the home police force of an individual. You know, we could do a whole podcast on the ineptitude of the West Yorkshire Police around their handling of information of the Surrey Police investigation, and of the fact of the you know, there, what came out after his death across many different police forces is there were records of Savile. You know, there were records that, you know, he was on the paedophile sort of files within Scotland Yard from the mid 1960s, and, you know, there were accounts, there were records of allegations of abuse and sexual assaults in Sussex, in North Yorkshire, in West Yorkshire, and there were records of police routinely going round to his house or his flats or his properties in Leeds, inquiring about the whereabouts of runaway girls. Again, stuff that he wrote about very openly in his, you know, in his autobiography. So his fingerprints, if you like, or his presence is there right the way in police records all the way across the country, but it just wasn't put together. Whether it was sort of willfully disappeared or deliberately disappeared, very difficult to say. I mean, I have grave suspicions about the West Yorkshire Police's handling, his home police force's handling of intelligence about Savile. And he had he was well known to police officers in the West Yorkshire Police. He had friends that visit, you know, friends who were police officers who visited his house. He had a West Yorkshire police officer who arranged the meeting, you know, the interview under caution with the Surrey Police as part of that Surrey Police investigation. So, yeah, I mean, I think ineptitude would be the kind way to put it.
And well, this was the same police force, of course, that famously bungled the Yorkshire Ripper investigation. Also,
many hundreds, if not thousands, of men were sort of brought into or questioned over that, including Jimmy Savile, because one of the victims was found in Roundhay Park outside his flat, which he didn't he just recently moved into. And Jimmy Savile was required to give a mould of his teeth because bite marks were found on this victim. And Savile was known in police circles to spend a lot of time in Chapel Town, you know, the red light district, you know, red light area of Leeds. So the fact that he was, and also Savile then in classic sort of Savile style, offered to be a sort of go-between between the police and the Ripper, because obviously there was an era of sort of fake or hoax phone calls or, you know, he was pulled into that. And he was very interested when the body was found in the park outside his house. And one of the police officers who, and I think it was the police officer who actually frisked me on that first visit, told me that he was very interested, you know, very interested in sort of in and about, you know, all the police that were in the park looking at that victim.
I mean, you also have a story where I think it was Gary Glitter, he was rung up or had a conversation with lawyers, basically to protect himself, because there were some suspicions about him. And he looked at you very obviously all the way through that phone call. Basically, he was sending a message to you that, you know, if you cause trouble, I can make trouble. Yeah, and I mean, you had the suspicion this may even have been a made-up call that someone just rang across the line.
It was actually the Haute de la Garenne Children's Home in Jersey, where there was a, you know, it was a children's home in Jersey where there was a sort of awful scandal broke out about abuse, and there was sort of, you know, suggestions that bodies had been found and maybe some children had been killed or murdered there. And a picture emerged of Savile at the home in the 1970s, surrounded by children. And he had moved to quash this as quickly as possible. And like you say, I was in his flat interviewing him, and there was this sort of big set piece phone call in which he was on the phone seemingly to his lawyers talking about how much he would take this newspaper down for and what he'd settled, you know, how much would be a good result for him. And yes, you know, we'll just do what we always do when the papers do this. We will threaten them and we will become very litigious. And he was looking me in the eye throughout this conversation, and then he put the phone down and said, well, that's how we handle that situation. And in the police interview, I know I keep coming back to this, but it is extraordinary, the Surrey Police interview under caution they did with him, he threatened the two Surrey police officers with the same thing. He said, you have to understand that I have a system. When this sort of thing happens, he even admitted it happened quite a lot, that there were these allegations, that he gives these sort of crazy letters, as he describes them, to police officers that he knows so that they can deal with it. I mean, and then he said, you know, if this goes further, you will find out how my system works, and that will involve us being in the Old Bailey and you having to face my very, very high-powered legal team. So there was this sort of implicit threat in everything that he said around that. And he did threaten, and he did successfully get a lot of money out of newspapers that tried to smear him. There's no doubt about it. The press were very aware of how litigious he was and very aware how connected he was. And I think the really interesting thing, there was a series of really quite lurid newspaper stories about him in 1983, at a time when his fame and popularity were perhaps at their peak. He was just about to open the newly rebuilt spinal injury centre at Stoke Mandeville. On one side of him standing Prince Charles, on the other side of him standing, you know, Princess Diana, his crowning achievement. You know, he knew that then the knighthood that without doubt Thatcher had promised him was going to be his, and he would be, as he told Lynn Barber, off the hook. And yet, in the build-up to that, The Sun ran this sort of three-day series of interviews with him that were very lurid about his, you know, to what Phil described, and Phil's father described, his sort of thuggish days in the dance halls, his very sort of mechanical view of the, and mechanical was a word he used, mechanical view of the opposite sex and sex itself. It was really dark, it was really sinister, and it was really out of kilter with what was about to happen, i.e. the success of a nationwide fundraising campaign to rebuild this essential medical facility, of which he had become sort of lionized, and yet this very, very odd series of stories. And, you know, I am sure that somebody had him, that one of the newspapers had him, and he did some sort of trade-off somewhere to be able, or threatened to pull the plug on the spinal injuries unit to do something like that, because, you know, his charitable foundation had a sort of ownership stake in it. So he was able to threaten people with that. And the quid pro quo was, well, give us something that's out of step with what we think of Jimmy Savile. And yet, and at the same time, he then traded it off with some other stories in other tabloids. I mean, it was just classic media maneuvering, crisis management, if you like. And that crisis management can only have been around allegations of what he was up to. And there was certainly at that time, there was, he'd made one of his biggest mistakes, which was making an appearance at a primary school in Leeds and then allowing a couple of these primary school children to come into his flat afterwards. And the father of one of these girls had found out about the fact that his daughter had been inside his flat and had hit the roof in no uncertain terms and threatened to expose him. And Savile told me that, in his words, he'd won the respect of Fleet Street because they'd had people parked outside his house for 2 years. They'd gone through his bins and they could find nothing. And in his words, I didn't even blink. And that won me the respect of Fleet Street. He was an arch operator and manipulator of the media and of all the sort of levers that control it.
And was he just abusing girls? And what sort of age of girls?
No, girls and boys, mainly girls. I would think that his, you know, there were many hundreds that came out. I mean, I think that probably they were pre-16. I imagine that the largest number would have been between 10 and 14. So they were underage girls. These were
and often
sort of,
from bad backgrounds, maybe in children's homes. You can see the picture you paint of his power, his connections, the importance he was to major institutions in the country.
And groupies.
How would they listen to a 14-year-old girl from some children's home?
Exactly.
Who's maybe been doing shoplifting or something. And you can just see it.
Exactly. I mean, nobody would believe. Why would anybody, as you correctly say, Phil, you know, why would anybody take this girl's word for it over this guy who was a huge celebrity, who was friends with the Prime Minister and the heir to the throne?
And the police.
I was on TV and raising money, and the parents all thought he was wonderful because he was this selfless bachelor who was sort of cycling the length of the country to raise money for hospitals. And actually, the thing that the institutions he was raising money for were the institutions that enabled his offending.
So was everything predicated? I mean, the whole career was predicated around the paedophilia, or do you think the two were sort of running in parallel and moved between the two?
I think that's a really good question. It's difficult to say. I don't know whether he created his career. I think power was the really key thing for him. When he held his first record dance, which was, you know, in the late 40s or early 50s, at a time when people went out and only danced to bands or orchestras, you know, it was all live music. And he hit upon this. He had a friend who'd created this sort of a gramophone with an amplified gramophone. So he was able to play records and people would dance to those records. And it was a very small event in a very small room in somewhere in Leeds. I can't remember where. And he talks about suddenly understanding the power he had over people by being able to make them dance, quickly or slowly. And then I think that understanding of power is what drove his career progression, because from there he took that idea into the dance halls and did that on a much larger scale. And he started to do it with two turntables rather than one. So he became the sort of, you know, the originator, one of the originators of modern DJ culture, if you like. And he changed the whole sort of paradigm around nightlife or dancing or popular music. But what And I asked him about this. I said, did you really love the music? Because he had no music in his house. And considering in any of his houses, considering he'd made his name as a DJ, made his name in the dance hall, made his name on radio, made his name in on television as you know, for Top of the Pops, which is all about pop music. There was never any music in his house. And I said to him, did you actually like the music? And he said, it wasn't about the music. It was about the power. And I think that sort of probably, whether it was about sort of paedophilia or whether the paedophilia came from the power, or the two, you know, the two things were sort of symbiotic. I think that would be my answer to that.
Well, we should
have the royal family distance themselves from him at all. I mean, since he died and these things have come out, I mean, has the king, for example, made any sort of statement, or has he just tried to brush it under the carpet?
I haven't seen any statements. I think it's probably been deeply embarrassing. I think it's been a question of sort of, you know, typical royal family, you know, don't say anything unless you really have to. Just pretend it didn't happen. But it did happen. And, you know, he was a key advisor, and he was somebody, not just to Charles, but the Duke of Edinburgh, you know, liked him, and he won over the Duke of Edinburgh. And the Duke of Edinburgh, according to Savile, you know, allowed Savile to use his press office to write letters on, you know, on the Duke of Edinburgh's headed notepaper to say, you know, the Duke of Edinburgh would be very grateful if you supported Jimmy Savile in this endeavor and stuff like that. So, and you know, he was asked to, according to Savile again, asked to stand in for members of the royal family at certain, you know, investitures and events, things like that. He was very, very, he was very much sort of liked. Obviously, he was like a court jester, I think. I mean, they probably found him incredibly odd. But the fact he had this, I think the thing that appealed to them about him was the fact he was a common man who had this ability to communicate with the people somehow. You know, he was seen as having the sort of common touch.
You talk about the power imbalance, but another, I think, difference between then and now is just what it meant to be famous. Jimmy Savile was properly famous.
Yes.
A household name. Tens of millions of people would watch him on the telly at a time when there were only two or maybe three TV stations, no internet, not much on the radio. He was properly, importantly famous. And I think that both impressed his potential victims, perhaps even drew some of them to him so he could groom them and exploit them. But it also really undermined those who tried to expose him.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. At a time when fame was, you know, this sort of boulder rolling down the mountainside of sort of British life and society. And I said, you know, I think I said at the outset, I do believe he was probably Britain's first celebrity in the sense of what we understand celebrity for now. He always said, I have no talent. I don't sing. I don't dance. I don't tell jokes. You know, he played other people's music. He was a sort of TV presenter. You know, he didn't have a talent. He was famous for being famous. And you're absolutely right. At a time when, you know, 20 million people would routinely tune in and watch Jim Will Fix It on a Saturday evening. And, you know, however many millions of people would tune into Top of the Pops every Thursday evening. It was a fixture.
There were whole comedians built their careers on doing impersonations of him.
Yes, including
Mike Yarwood, the Grumbleweeds. I can think of loads of people.
Yeah, well,
that was their main thing. Oh, look, he sounds like Jimmy Savile.
Steve Coogan, you know, who did a fantastic job. I mean, a really incredible job playing Savile in the Reckoning, the recent BBC dramatization of my book. You know, even he, you know, made quite a bit of capital out of doing. I mean, he did impersonations of many people, but Savile was one of them. I mean, he was a stock impersonation. Everybody had a Savile impersonation. It would be now then, or guys and gals, and you know, they were just this sort of, and these sort of inane catchphrases were again just part of this facade with the jewelry.
Yeah. I love your description of the court gesture. You sort of think also the Lord of Misrule as well. He speaks to something in us that's quite kind of old, I think, and rather strange. And he was very strange and very British. It's impossible to imagine someone like that in France, I think.
Thing about Savile as well is he was always old. I mean, even at a time, you know, when he was starting to really make a name for himself in the dance halls. These are teenage kids dancing around to the hits of the late 50s and early 60s as rock and roll was erupting across society. And then, you know, the Beatles and the sort of British sound. He was in his mid-30s, moving towards 40. You know, he was born in 1926. He was always old. He was this sort of, and there's something about that sort of court jester clown-like persona. There's something, you know, many people are terrified of clowns, and he had that. I mean, I described him as almost like a Mr. Punch. He looked like Mr.
Great
Punch.
Great expression.
Yeah, he had that sort of, you know, that sort of long nose and that sort of air of menace that you didn't quite know when the iron fist was going to be revealed from the velvet glove. And
frisk him.
Yeah, to your point, you know, what your father said about him, he reveled in those stories. He was very open about telling those stories about how he tied up troublemakers in his dance halls. And my theory about him for many years of interviewing him and researching him, and what kept pulling me back was the fact that here was this guy who was so famous, who was so well known, who was so instantly identifiable, but nobody knew who he was. Nobody knew who he was, even despite the fact of him being this, you know, this sort of incredibly public figure who survived on the oxygen of publicity and sought it everywhere. Nobody knew who he was.
Well, I know we promised to let you go after an hour, and we're nearly up. Yeah. But I could talk for hours about this man, and I think you've absolutely nailed him and captured his kind of dark strangeness so well.
And the period and the celebrity culture, you know, it's a very wide-ranging book, actually.
I think that I always thought, you know, before I knew what he was, and I was really struggling with what this book was, and I said to you, it was, you know, going to be called Apocalypse Now then, and it was going to sort of, I was going to be Willard, and he was this sort of Kurtz-like figure, and it was sort of almost, in a way, because I couldn't work out this thing, and it was like, what did it say about me that I was as obsessed as I was about this person? But what I felt that it could do, and I think that hopefully I have achieved this, is that it shines a light on an extraordinary sweep of post-war British popular culture. He is this flickering, malignant light, this Zelig-like character who pops up in all these unlikely scenarios. And through his sort of presence, however unlikely that might be, it does shine a light on pockets of the story of post-war Britain, you know, whether that's at a government level, at the, you know, in the royal family, whether it's within popular culture, whether it's in sort of, you know, working class society, whatever else. And I think, you know, I think that that was something I was very conscious of, because he had such a long life, and he was in the public eye for such a very long time.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this with us. It's one of our most interesting conversations. Really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Happy to come back
if you ever want to continue. But
I think we probably will. Thanks so much, Dan.
Come back.
All the best.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.